hands. What can I touch? I move it all around.
Band playing The Spinners, I'll Be Around at the April 12, 2012 Downtown Arts Walk. Welcome to the Coon Round Report, coming at you live from Skid Row Studios. May the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. My name is Melvin Ishmael Johnson, and I'm in the studio with my co-host, Earlene Anthony and Tyrone Robinson.
Good evening.
This week we will be talking about the creative music artist with Randy Belfield, the driving force of the Passion Band, Price's Mr. Swagger, who is a Zambian premier hip-hop artist. Also with us in the studio is two USC students, Shadia Hagi Sufi and Michelle Kwan from the nonprofit organization Yelitari. I would like to welcome all of you to the Coon Round Report.
Hello.
Hey.
Now, Randy, I would like to start with you. Could you tell us a little about yourself, you know, where you grew up at and how you got into music?
Well, I grew up in between Paterson, New Jersey and Harlem, New York. I started playing drums, 1963, long time ago. Kind of started playing drums. My mother had a Cub Scout troop, and I guess I was the drummer for the parades and whatnot. And, you know, things just developed. Other members of the scout troop started playing instruments. We put together a little small band, you know, when we were in grammar school. Excuse me. I guess right through grammar school, right into high school, you know, the band developed. We used to play a lot of the local clubs, parties and whatnot, up and down the coast, New Jersey, Florida, you know, Maine, Boston. Mm-hmm. And let me see. In high school, I actually left high school my second year and joined the Marines. And actually got a couple of chances to play while I was in the Marines, you know, USO clubs and different events for the soldiers and whatnot. And I've just been playing music ever since.
Yeah. One Marine to another.
Oh, yeah, Semper Fi.
Yes. Now, look, you also play for some churches throughout the Los Angeles area. Which do you prefer the most, gospel music or what they call secular music, like jazz, blues, or hip-hop?
Actually, you know, music to me is all the same. It's basically, you know, giving people or crowds a chance to, you know, go through an emotional thing. whether it's a love song or whether it's, you know, a gospel song, depending on, you know, what church you go to or what your religious preference is. So basically, it's all the same to me. I'm just a musician. So
Now, your original instrument was the drum, and then how many instruments you play now that you move?
Probably about six, but I'm mostly a drummer, bass player, and percussionist. So I dabble in a little keyboards, guitar, maybe violin.
But drumming is your centralized point.
No, actually, it goes between drums and bass. I've done a lot of studio work and a lot of tours, basically, you know, either doing bass work, drum work, and also, you know, as a tech, too.
Because I know you, when you was in the Code Zero band, Ron Allen's excellent band, you was a drummer in that band.
Yeah. I did drums for him for a while, and actually, in between the time that we were changing bass players, I did some of the bass work also.
Yeah, great group. Now, how did the Passion Band come about?
Well, once I'd been back and forth to L.A. with different tours and whatnot, you know, I had a chance to work with, you know, artists out here like Patrice Rushen and some of the other artists from the West Coast. Mostly, I was mostly centralized in New York, but, you know, touring, you go back and forth coast to coast. So when I came out this time, I originally came out here to go to school. And it was a music, you know, music school. And I got probably halfway through the school and the school went. So I got kind of stuck out here. And I was like, well, you know, because I was only supposed to be out here for a year. And I said, well, you know, let me do something. Let me do what I know how to do. And, you know, through working in different clubs and different bands and whatnot, I started to, you know, get to know other musicians that were on the local scene. Because it seemed like the musicians that were touring a lot, they kind of had a little, I don't want to call it a clique, but I guess it is a clique. You know, and I tried to break into that a couple of times and it was sort of impenetrable. So I figured, well, let me just find some of the local musicians, you know, put together something small, and from there, you know, I'll develop.
So yeah, you guys got a nice little nucleus. Are you planning on going into the studio and putting an album, a CD, or something together soon?
Actually, what I'm trying to do at the moment, what I've been trying to do actually for the last year, is put a decent video together. I have a few people in other countries that, you know, that I've worked for before, that have seen me before, that have been asked me for a package. So I'm basically trying to get the band out of state, out of the country. But, you know, with some of the local musicians, it's a little hard for them to see that vision when they've never been on the other side before.
Yeah.
So right now it's basically a training period. And hopefully by the end of the summer, I'll be able to have that whole package together and be ready to at least make an attempt at leaving the country.
Now, you got a great keyboard player, too. That I'm, what's his name? I'm impressed with him. I like him a lot.
That's Walter Barrelix. He's from New Orleans, Louisiana.
Oh, wow. Yeah, he got that nice little down-earth sound to him also.
Real doctor.
Yeah. Okay, Randy, thank you very much. We're coming back to you in our round table discussion.
Okay. Now,
we're also delighted to have with us in the studio Zambia's premier hip-hop artist, Crisis Mr. Swagger. He's a multi-award winner and nominee. In 2011, he was Zambia's first and only solo artist nominated for a Channel O Award for the most gifted African Southern video. His song, The Fire Inside, competed against some of the best acts in South Africa. Mr. Swagger, welcome to the Coon Rap Report.
Thanks, Melvin.
Welcome, yeah. Crisis.
Thanks, everybody. Yeah, first I would like to read something about the history of Zambia so our audience will understand how important Zambia was to the emerging African liberation movements of the late 50s and the early 60s. Zambia, officially the Republic of Zambia. It is a landlocked country in South Africa. The neighboring countries are the Democratic Republic of the Congo to the north, Tanzania to the northeast, Malawi to the east, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Botswana, Namibia to the south, and Angola to the west. The capital city is Lusaka, located in the south-central part of the country. The population is concentrated mainly around the capital, originally inhabited by the Kushan people. The region which compromised Zambia was colonized during the Bantu expansion of the 13th century. After visit by European explorers in the 18th century, Zambia became the British colony of northern Rhodesia towards the end of the 19th century. For most of the colonial period, the country was governed by an administrative appointed from London with the advice of the British South African Company, one of those corporations we always talk about on this show. On October, the 24th of October 1964, the country declared independence from the United Kingdom, and then Prime Minister Kenneth Kaunda became the first president of Zambia. So, can you talk a little about the importance of Zambia's first president?
Now known as Dr. Kenneth David Kaunda, he just the day before yesterday was celebrating his 88th birthday. And actually it brought me to think how important of a figure he's been in, you know, not only my country's history, but also Africa's history, because he's one of the people that actually provided refuge for some of the people that had nowhere to go. You know, people like Jacob Zuma, who was the former president. Exactly. They actually, at some point, including Nelson Mandela, were once in Zambia because they couldn't go back to South Africa for a certain period of time. And he gave them shelter when they needed it. Mm-hmm. And he helped countries like South Africa, Zimbabwe, help gain independence. And he also, most importantly, helped not only liberate our country, but help, you know, he put the word out on the importance of the liberation and independence of African countries as a whole, mm-hmm. and not just, you know, our country. His intention was not selfish. Most people have visions and they're self-centered visions. But his intention, which is, you know, a bigger vision than most people would have. It's when you take on a task that big where you have to liberate a whole country, you're risking your life, because some of the people that he was in the struggle with, Harry Mwanga Nkumbula, they passed away. Some people were killed, you know, so it was, yeah, he is an important figure.
Person. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now let's talk a little about you and your music. Tell us a little about your early life and how you got into music.
I was born in Lusaka, Zambia, which is the capital city for my country, Zambia. And I was born almost at the same time as hip-hop music. I can't say the year.
okay.
But in my early life, as always, and nothing's changed, I always had a big appetite. And I remember sitting in the kitchen with my mother. She was cooking a meal. And the radio was on, and on came Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five.
Whoa.
It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep on going under. And I heard that the first time, and that was on radio. There was an American DJ who came to my country in exile. Mike Tabor, may his soul rest in peace. Mm-hmm. And he was one of the few DJs playing hip-hop on Zambian radio. So I waited for more hip-hop to come back, and surely later on the next day, about the same time, he played more hip-hop by Sugar Hill Gang and Grandmaster Flash again. And I started thinking to myself, because I loved nursery rhymes, so it was relative that I fell in love with hip hop because of the rhyming schemes behind it and everything.
So that's
how I decided to start trying to write raps. And my mother's Dolly Parton tapes disappeared, and they had hip hop recorded over them.
Okay. Now, how about the influence of like South African musicians like Hugh Masekela, Mary McKeeble. Mm-hmm. What kind of influence did they have on your music?
I guess those, you know, they, Miriam Makeba now passed away, may her soul rest in peace, but Hugh Masekela, I met him once at an award show. I used to look up to him and still do. I think he's an amazing musician. He came at a time where, you know, again, South Africa was going through the liberation struggle. They had struggles with apartheid. They were fighting against the government that they did not vote for. They were fighting against a system that totally mistreated the black people. And he helped not only liberate the people, but I guess get their minds off the struggle that they were going through. And that taught me what I could do with music is to reach out even for 3 minutes and get people to think about something other than maybe the problems that they have and possibly get them to zone out and, you know, journey with me through music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. Yes. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Swagger. Look, we'll be hearing from you in the round table and also in the ether portion of the show. We're going to hear some of your music in that section. Now I would like to talk to two students from USC who is with an organization that they're going to tell us about, which means empowerment. Shadia Haji Sufi and Michelle Kwan, welcome to the Qumran Report.
Thank you for having us.
Okay, can you tell us a little about yourself and the organization?
Well, my name is Shadia Haji Sufi. I was born in Somalia, raised in Switzerland, and I came here about 12 years ago. I came to USC 3 years ago, majored in international relations. And growing up, I was really interested in women's rights and, you know, the rights of children. And I just got introduced to our founder, Avielle Tare, Moussa Boukoum, and we had that French connection, you know, we both speak French. And then he talked to me about the organization, and I just was instantly hooked and wanted to be part of it.
What language did you pick up first, French or English?
My native language is Somali. And then I learned French, you know, in school, growing up in Switzerland, and then English.
How many languages do you speak?
I speak three.
Three, okay, yeah. Beautiful. Okay, Michelle.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Okay, well, I was born in New York, like you, Randy, except I was born on Long Island, and I lived there until I was 12 or 13, and then I also moved to Switzerland, so I went to high school there, and then I came to USC, and I'm currently majoring in neuroscience. And I heard about Yella Tare, actually, because I took a French class where Moussa was the professor. And initially, it was just the normal student-professor relationship. But every time we had an essay assignment or an in-class discussion, I'd always talk about how I really want to help ameliorate the quality of life for oppressed people. And I really have this interest in the African continent, and I really want to visit Africa one day. And so one day he comes up to me after class and he's like, hey, you'd be perfect for my organization. What do you think? And it really appealed to my, you know, I don't know, my compassionate, empathetic side. And I guess all of these interests that I'd expressed. So
Let me ask you something.
Okay.
What was it that drew you to Switzerland? I want to ask you, what was it that drew you to Switzerland?
Oh, actually, my dad works for the United Nations, and he got a job placement at the headquarters in Geneva. So my whole family just moved over there with him.
Yes. And what drew you to USC?
Good question. I actually, because I mean, it's so far, but I had applied to a bunch of different schools all over the world, I guess. And USC ended up being just the most friendly, I guess. When I emailed, I don't know, people at USC asking for more information, they were always very warm, and just the whole process was very accessible.
Okay, let's talk about the organization for a while. I see that you have some good PowerPoints here And I would like to get you two to talk about them for a while. Scripts and Songs for Change. What is that about?
All right. Well, Scripts and Songs for Change is our, I guess, media-based awareness-raising campaign or aspect of our general campaign. And essentially, I mean, as the name implies, it's based around scripts and songs. And so what we are going to do is have a bunch of international contestants submit ideas for scripts for films or song ideas that are about this human rights issue of child marriage, which is what our current campaign is about. And from all of these international submissions, we'll pick the top 20 and then collaborate with professional music artists and directors and actors and actresses and have them produced into real professional quality products that we will then distribute internationally and play at festivals and on radio stations. And through that means raise awareness about our issue.
Mm-hmm. So you're going to connect the film with the music, like the soundtrack, the music throughout the film?
Yeah, because we feel that really media is I guess with the people here, it's not really untapped, but in general society, we feel like it's an untapped resource that can really be used to raise awareness about a lot of different issues in the world. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is on the front page now, dealing with women's issues, child soldiers, et cetera, right. Forced marriage, all that kind of material. Can you talk a little about the tree that you talked a little earlier, the tree?
Okay, the Palver tree is an old, a really old traditional institution where people from the community would come and talk about their issues or their concerns. Maybe if someone got into a conflict, they would come under the palver tree and, you know, say whatever was wrong, and the village elders would come and basically make a ruling and say, you're wrong, you're right. But what we're going to be doing with the palaver tree is using this old, you know, technique, but like remixing it. This way, we're not just going to have, you know, the older people or the elders talk and make the decisions, but the younger people who are, you know, the ones being affected by, you know, this issue, they can be expressing their concerns and have, you know, the older people listen to them instead of just, you know, making decisions for them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, how about the issue of the empowerment of women's in income-generating activities?
That's actually a good, a very vital part of our campaign as well, because we feel, first of all, whenever there's any real human rights violation or a global issue that deals with humanitarian problems, these things arise from more infrastructural, political, economic, social sort of issues. Like, I guess in the Kony 2012 issue that recently arose this past year, people were under the impression that this entire problem where children were being kidnapped and used as child soldiers centered around this one man, Joseph Kony. And for some reason, everyone was under the impression that if this one man were to be captured, this whole problem would go away. But when Osama bin Laden was stopped, did terrorism stop? No. This one problem this one person is never the whole source of the problem. And so we're trying to tackle, we're not saying that economics is the only reason why child marriage happens, but we're trying to tackle child marriage as an issue from the more economic side as well. And so we feel that by empowering women and children and by creating more opportunities for them to create their own income, their families will be less, I guess, pushed into forcing them into marriage in order to create the, like, income through their own marriage. I mean, there are a lot of families who aren't even able to feed themselves, and so as a last resort, they in a sense sell their own daughters just to get food to feed their other children. If these daughters were to instead be able to use a certain skill set to produce their own income, this would not have to be the like, I don't know, the life path for that girl.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think it has a lot to do with the type of economic system in which these particular countries is living under? You think, do you see that have any relationship to that? The child marriage, what we see happening over there. Is this pervasive in both capitalist and socialist countries, et cetera, like that? Or
that's a good question. I don't know. I don't think that the problem originates in the economic system or structure of a country. I think it's more based on access to opportunities, to educational and career opportunities for these, I don't know, these individuals.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We're going to discuss this a little bit more when we get into the roundtable discussion, because I know both Tyrone and Earlene will have some questions. One more thing. Can you talk a little about the Mobile campaign for the voluntary HIV screening? Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, because child marriage is actually a practice that really encourages the spread of HIV and other STIs. For like, if you have a 10-year-old girl who's being forced to marry a 50-year-old man, he's had so much more sexual experience than this child. And he's definitely going to give her any STIs that he's caught in the past. And especially in the African continent, where the HIV pandemic is a real issue that's currently being addressed, we feel that it's very, I don't know, this is an issue that really needs to be tackled on head first. And so so this mobile campaign for HIV screening is essentially where we're going to set up HIV screening units all around West Africa and voluntarily target the communities which are most at risk for HIV transmission. So this includes sex workers and soldiers and people who are involved with these people and closely related to them. And I can't remember at the moment, but a few other populations as well. And we're going to give them the opportunity to get tested to know their HIV status. Mm-hmm. We feel that that will help to prevent transmission of HIV.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, can you tell us again the name of your organization and the meaning of it? Because I thought that was very interesting.
The name of our organization is Yeletare, which means empowerment.
Empowerment. Yes. Okay. Okay. And now we're going to take a short break for our community calendar, and then we'll come back to open up to our roundtable discussion. At this time, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Earlene Anthony for our community calendar.
This is the community calendar for the month of May, Sunday, May the 6th, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. The Veterans Project, the Roby Theater Company, Drama Stage Qumran, U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs and the Vortex presents the first annual Veteran Stand Down. The location will be at the Vortex, 2341 East Olympic Boulevard in Los Angeles, California. And if you're traveling by the bus, the number 60 Metro bus will take you to Santa Fe and Olympic. And this is a time that we're going to honor and remember our veterans. Some of the service providing will include eligibility screening, medical exam, on-site housing referrals, counseling, clothing and hygiene giveaway, breakfast and lunch will be served, and many more services will be provided. For more information on the stand down, you can call 323-850-4436 or 310-478-3711, extension 40187. And on Thursday, May the 10th, from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m., Melvin Ishmael Johnson will be directing a Veterans Community Theater Company. It will be a 7-week workshop. And at the conclusion, there will be a performance of a stage play that they will be working on during the course of the workshop. And if you want to be in the workshop, please respond as soon as possible. Seating is limited to 15 veterans, and this is a free workshop. The location will be at the Vortex, 2341 East Olympic Boulevard, Los Angeles, California. And for more information, you can call 323-850-4436. Sunday, May the 13th at 3 p.m., Drama Stage Qumran, the Sana Play Reading Series will present Our Mother's Daughters, a stage play written by yours truly, Earlene Anthony, and directed by Melvin Ishmael Johnson. And this is a reminder that Sunday, May 13th, is Mother's Day. We will be serving a Mother's Day dinner, and you're invited to just come out and help us honor and remember our mothers on this day. The location will be The Exchange, 114 West 5th Street, Los Angeles, California. And for more information on this event, you can call 323-850-4436. And if you have a community event that you would like announced on our show, send the information to dramastage1@yahoo.com, attention Earlene Anthony. And once again, our call-in number for the show is 800-893-9562. Now back to our host.
Hey, thank you, Earlene Anthony. We're back with our guests, and I would like to open up our discussion to our roundtable. And first thing I want to talk about is the relationship between gangs, violence, and hip-hop here in America. But first of all, what is hip-hop? Can someone want to throw a definition on what you think hip-hop? What is hip-hop?
Sure. Hip-hop is it's a culture that that's derived from rap music, rhythm and poetry, which is what rap is, because you would be rapping in a rhythm, you know, you would be basically reciting poetry in a rhythm, and that's why it's called rap, rhythm and poetry. Hip-hop was more it's a byproduct of rap music that was basically taken more to the streets, it was more, rap was more hardcore and, you know, underground, while hip-hop, when they created hip-hop, hip-hop became more like the fun part of rap music. And then it incorporated b-boying, which would be, you know, breakdancing, graffiti art is all part of the hip-hop culture. As you know, my name is Mr. Swagger, and mm-hmm. back in the day, not a lot of people use swagger, but swagger is kind of like an aura. The way you walk, the way you talk, it's not something you can turn on and turn off. It's a way of life. It's something that's, it's almost natural. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and DJing is also a part of the hip-hop culture. Mm-hmm. So, yes, hip-hop is a culture.
Now, that's interesting. That's the first time I got a definition mm-hmm. for rap, mm-hmm. rhythm, mm-hmm. and poetry. Huh?
That's right.
Okay, that's the first time I heard it. That's very interesting. Now, how about this connection? There's a couple of things I want to talk to you about. I want to throw it out here. Is there a connection between hip-hop, gangs, violence, et cetera, like that? Let's talk about here in the United States first, in these inner cities. Mm-hmm. Anybody want to pick up on that?
Well, I've always had this opinion about gangs after spending 8 years in the military and visiting places like the Philippines or Mombasa, Kenya, places where there were militias or places where... under martial law, here in the United States, we call them gangs, but over there, they're called guerrillas. You know, you would find the same resources, legal or illegal, black market or whatever. You go to your local gangs or you go to the local guerrillas. So, I think even in terms of a lot of Hispanic music, traditional Hispanic music, like, El Grupo de Norte, they're I wouldn't say gang related, but their music deals with that type of
environment.
Yeah, that type of environment, that localization. Mm-hmm. What's your feelings?
I think that that's, you know, some of the that's one of the downsides of hip hop, and I like to think that not so much these days, because it's coming back to what it was again. more fun in the music and, you know, bringing joy in hard times. Yeah, but it's sad to note that other people have basically taken rap lyrics to a point where they take it personal. Anything that they hear on a record and competition also becomes personal sometimes, you know. And that's what causes, you know, people to side with gangs, hip-hop artists coming from a gang, because maybe this guy was with the Bloods and he's successful now. And, you know, there might be jealousy from the Crips or vice versa. I don't really know how it works in the U.S., but the only thing that I can see is it's cliques, separate people, and egos, which is really, I find it really unnecessary. I've had to defuse quite a lot of, you know, rap battles myself, being in the position that I've been in back home, a pioneering hip-hop artist. You get people that want to discredit you, young guys coming up, they want to discredit you and you know, blow you out the frame. So, yeah.
You talking about back home?
Yeah, back home. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, over here, it's on a whole nother level. If it gets like that, guns get cocked. Yeah. People get shot sometimes. And, you know, if anybody's listening, let's stop the violence.
Yeah. Now, what's happening in the communities back in Zambia in terms of the, it's a hip-hop community there also, right?
I mean, when I released my first album, I had a lot of conflict with people telling me, what are you doing? Plus, I use a lot of English in my music. And a lot of people are telling me this will never work. But once the album was released, it took off. I don't know, you know, if it's still the highest selling hip hop album, because I haven't been home for a minute. But yeah, I mean, people have now embraced the culture. When we were starting, there was a lot of doubt it wouldn't work, but now people have embraced the culture and it's also evolved locally. And I'm also trying to bring that internationally and just bring something different to the game.
Okay. Now, Randy, let me ask you this. Do you see a similarity between when jazz came on the scene to the way rap and hip-hop came on the scene? You know, and also, is this a new musical form that we're talking about here?
Well, yes and no, if you remember The Last Poets. So, I mean, you know, that same thing was going on back then.
In the 60s.
Yeah, exactly. And it was really a message. But, you know, now with the, I guess, you know, with the electronics and more of a band setting, you know, like the brother said, they're taking it to a different level. But it's, you know, as life progresses, so does music. You know, and it's just evolving, that's all.
And let me ask you something else about that I'm interested in. You're familiar with Skid Row, right? With Skid Row, you know, the homeless capital. Los Angeles is the homeless capital of the world, definitely of the United States. Over 80 to 100,000 people sleep on the street here in L.A. County every night. And Skid Row, the downtown area, where mainly we work with our theater company, is there an area comparable to that in your country?
There's a lot of it's there's a lot of areas, you know,
the homeless.
Yes, there's a lot of homeless people in my country, and I guess it's the same thing. Sometimes, you know, sometimes I when I walk the streets of LA, I see a lot of opportunity, and at the same time, I sometimes wish that I had those opportunities afforded to me back home, because America is so much more developed than Africa. But you need to remember, well, not Africa, I would say some countries in Africa, because South Africa is now competing. But I would say, at the same time, you can't really say that it's, you know, some of the causes of people being homeless are not economical. Some could be mental. Some could be, you know, social, you know, stress and different things. So, yes, there's a lot of places like that in my country.
Okay. We're going to get into the ether in just 1 second. One more thing I want to throw out here. And when we come back from the ether, this is one thing I want to talk about in relationship to USC in terms of how to get the student community and the community members to work a little closer together and understanding, especially in relationship to those two students who just lost their life, who live in the USC community. But at this time, I want to turn it over to Tyrone for our Voices from the Ether section.
Yeah! If it's Monday night, 20 minutes to 9, then you're listening to Voices from the Ether. Our in-studio guest, his music is playing in the background. Bryce is Mr. Swagger. You learned all about him in the first part of our show. So without further delay, from high downtown LA, and he is premier hip-hop artist, Mr. Swagger.
Okay, this song, as you can hear, was inspired by the 2010 World Cup. You can catch me in a city doing 100 miles an hour. I ain't like them other cats that's doing 100 miles and running. I'm moving forward and maintaining position. Whatever place I want in the game is my decision. Me, I'm a train driver, you don't want no collision. I'm African and ain't nobody with my sort of vision. My boy Max Jimmy told me go hard. Now I play the game, I'm feeling like a rapping Mozart. This ain't a battle of the sexes. I hope you had breakfast. Now welcome to the battle of the bestest. Cats talking about swag, what you talking about? Copyright owners over here, what you talking about? It's like the first earthquake was felt in Haiti. A lot of broken homes and a few surviving babies. You're not alone, it can be and it'll never be. See me on the stage, you better holler, man, remember me.
Okay, we're gonna go into our second piece now.
Okay. This is a little story, you know what I mean? About where I'm coming from. How I grew up and everything. How I got into the rap game. Yo. I used to run around in the streets on Cairo Road, trying to get some money to eat. I used to sell CDs in Soweto Market, just to get a little bit of money in my pocket. My shorty had a baby on the way. She used to tell me, like, crisis, you would lose. I was like, no way. Every day I was hustling hard, talking to God, thinking, damn, yo, why the hell is life so hard? You never seen my struggle. Where you wake up starving and you know you gotta use every muscle. I've been with the thugs and they know where I came from. That's why they're giving me hugs. I got the world on my back, the future in front of me, and a million plus fans to follow me. Holla back. I got the world on my back and the future in front of me. Come on. Thanks to Universal Music for this. Celine Dion chorus. Listen, verse 2. We're live in the studio. Hey yo, I'm reading from a book where my future's written. It says he came from a humble background to the Billboard charts. Damn, I don't even know how I did it, but I knew that if I worked with the Lord, then I could get it. Everybody telling me that I should go overseas, like money just grows on trees. Like I could just decide to pack my bags and say I'm leaving for America. I'm gonna be a big star, but it's never that simple. Big cars, big cribs, and big chips. It'll happen in good time. I know I'm gonna get it. The crisis, ambitious. With big dreams, whispers and fake flows, I'm gonna kill them. And I know that you think I can't make it on my own, cause you never see God on my side when I walk. And if you thought that I was just another dude, think again, this is money in the bank when I rap. If you got a vision, you got a dream, don't give up. Know what I mean? The only thing stopping you is you. We're live in the studios. Skid Row Radio. Yo. I remember coming up in the game like back in the day when I was just a kid watching flashy kids. They used to say I was a Dr. Dre wannabe. Now they all wanna be friends. So who's a wannabe now, huh? Holla at your boy, man. Listen, I've been around, looked around, no competition. This is the passion of the crisis, the hunger for more. Give me a river, cause my thirst never ends. I came from the bottom up. I'm on top of the world now. I'm even handshaking with God. I know you're feeling yourself. You're better off just killing yourself, cause you ain't moving no units on the shelf. I'm a hot dog. Photographs up in the newspaper. I gotta do an interview. I'll see you later, man. Photographs up in the newspaper. I gotta do an interview. I'll see you later, man. My name's Crisis, Mr. Swagger. Skid Row Radio. That's the way it is. DiamondChainMusic.com. Special shout out to Africa. Connecting with the U.S.
Peace.
Thank you, Mr. Swagger.
Thank you.
This week's shout-out goes to Dare to Care, a substance abuse program. They are looking for donations of food, clothing, and employment opportunities for the women they serve. For more information about how you can help or mail donations to Dare to Care, 14325 South Figueroa Street, Los Angeles, California, 90248, or you can call 310-515-5039. Let them know you heard about this through the ether. That concludes tonight's visit to the ether. And now back to the show's host, Melvin Ishmael Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Tyrone. That was great.
Thank you.
Great.
Thank you.
Now, I want to get a little bit back into our roundtable discussion. And then I also want to have some comments from each one of our guests. So we have the contact information for those who want to contact you. But I want to talk a little about the student community relationship, especially around USC. I know we just had some mention earlier. We had an incident where two students was robbed, killed, who lived in the community. Now USC sits in a community that at one time was known for a lot of gang activities, the Hoover Crips, the Roland, the 20s, the 60s, that surrounds the campus. How can the what are your thoughts on ways to get the community and the university life, the student, to work more closely together to bridge that gap, especially in the a campus like USC that sits in the heart of the community?
Well, the relationship between the USC student body and the local community has been a really central issue to the university ever since its start. Like, there's always been this whole debate about, oh, USC thinks it's superior to the community, it places itself on a pedestal and isolates itself. But then there are also a lot of advocates for the opposite side who say that, no, USC is making a wholehearted effort to really become more engaged with the residents of the area directly around it. So, I mean, different people will reply differently to this question, but I'm a firm believer of, or a pretty firm believer of, the school of thought that says that USC is, I mean, it's not trying as hard as it could be, but it is trying to get more engaged with the community through a lot of different ways. There are a lot of programs that send USC volunteers out to the local community to act as like tutors or mentors to students in local schools, or a lot of classes, for example, USC students will be sent out to learn more about issues that are relevant to the area that we reside in. Mm-hmm. So through different programs like this, I think slowly USC students are becoming more engaged in the community, and hopefully eventually we'll become better mm-hmm. integrated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How about you, Shandy? What your thoughts on?
Well, I was just going to say about what Michelle said, but I do feel that there is a disconnect between the USC community and the surrounding areas, but I think that a lot of it is not because of the students' fault. I feel like it's part of their background. A lot of, you know, USC is it's a private school, you know. A lot of people are, you know, coming from parents who have, you know, high incomes. So coming into, you know, this area where, you know, people are making, I don't know, a third, a tenth of, you know, their parents' income, it can be very, like, intimidating for these students. So I think there's a lot of fear that is going on between the two communities, but I also feel that they are trying to understand the community a lot better.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, Tyrone, Earlene, questions?
You guys said we met at a fundraiser. That's how we all first met.
Yes.
And is this how the majority of your funding for these projects that you're planning on doing is coming from, or what other funding sources do you have?
Well, we're working with a lot of different, in a lot of different areas. For example, we're trying to get funding from governments. Mm-hmm. We are trying to get funding from different organizations, or maybe even, you know, companies having sponsors. But that event that you came to mm-hmm. was a very, very small event mm-hmm. compared to what we're actually trying to do. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Earlene?
I kind of tossed this around with Michelle earlier, but I think I'm going to have to change my question because she answered most of it before. But you have such a heart for people of Africa.
Yeah.
Can you kind of explain why you have such a heart for Africa, or when did it occur? Or are you, you know, at an early age or what?
Oh, sure. The thing is, I think my parents raised me to be really compassionate and empathetic towards others. And when I was really young, that manifested as being like an animal lover, and like animals in plight, my heart would go out to them. And then as I went to school and I got older, I would learn about history and current affairs and learn about human rights violations and all these oppressed individuals. And I would think, wow, I can picture myself being in that situation, and that would just be so awful. Like, at the end of the day, everyone just wants to go to sleep happy, you know? They want to think to themselves, man, I'm happy with the way my day went today. And so many people live in a situation where they don't have days like that. They're starving, they're sick, their family is sick, they can't feed each other. I mean, it's just really sad. And when I learned about, like, the African continent and how many troubles afflict it, I don't know, my heart just really went out to the people. And I know there are struggling people on every continent, but I feel like Africa in particular, really, I mean, they're just, it's just very unlucky as, like, a whole, with, like, a HIV pandemic, so many economic problems, political issues, just so many civil wars in so many of the countries. And I just really want to do whatever I can to help the people there, so... Yeah.
And it's the cradle of mankind.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and it's so plagued by all these things.
Right. You know? It's truly unfortunate.
Yeah.
Okay, we still got a little time left. I want to go around with our guests, starting with Randy, you know, for some final comments. And then would you give us the contact information for those who would want to bring the Passion Band out to play or perform?
Yeah, but can I ask a question? I had the opportunity to go to Africa back in 73 and a couple of times while I was in the military. And just for the gentleman and the young lady from
Somalia.
Right. Mm-hmm. I'm not very political, but I do consider myself a novice historian. It seems like, and I'm just looking at it from an outside point of view in front of a few times that I've been there, but it seems like the countries that are occupied by the dictators mm-hmm. who get funds from other countries, quote unquote, the U.S., mm-hmm. it would seem like somewhere along the way, the people would, I guess they're starting to do it now with the uprisings. It seemed like the people would in some form or another say, we've had enough with these dictators, because the money that's supposed to come into the country, whether it's resources from the country or money that's coming in from another aid source, it would seem like the dictators, or the people rather, would just say, we've had enough and we're going to overthrow these guys and get them out. And I'm not just saying like Gaddafi and a few of the other ones that have been going on, but from some of the other countries, like the Congo. I understand there's a big problem in Nigeria now. Mm-hmm. And
Sudan.
Yeah, Ethiopia, Somali, you know. And I'm just, again, I've only been to Africa a couple of times, and I've been there just as a musician and maybe as a soldier on leave. But I'll just try to get a perspective from you guys. What... Can you just enlighten me as much as you can?
Well, people have, you know, been in revolutions. I mean, a lot of, you know, the leaders right now, you know, came through with like military coups, or, you know, the people just rising up against the, you know, leader or dictator. But with the case of Africa, I think sometimes it's kind of tricky, because sometimes dictators, I mean, this might sound funny, but it actually kind of helps, you know, if like there's a strong, very strong central leader mm-hmm. that, you know, creates stability.
Right.
So a lot of people don't really care about, you know, what's going on with the government, but rather, you know, how you're living. Do you have enough to eat? Do you know... Do you have your health care? You know, are people shooting at you? For example, in my country, Somalia, there's not really a government, basically. It's a transitional government right now.
Right.
But you can see by that it's basically anarchy. People, you know, mm-hmm. are doing whatever they want. Mm-hmm. And the government's role, you know, is supposed to take care of the people, but there's no government right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they call Somalia the failed state.
Yeah.
Okay, we're winding down. Can you give us your contact information real quick?
Okay.
Oh, sure. The Yellowtari website is yellowtari.org, and it's kind of a weird word. So Yellowtari is Yellitarre. Taarre. My bad.
Okay.
.org, or just email us at info@yellitarre.org.
Okay. Christ.
For artist booking and for any further information, you can call if you're in the States, 323-244-7901, or hit me up on facebook.com/contactcrisis. On Twitter @HipHopCrisis. And to hit the website, just go to www.diamondchainmusic.com. The best diamonds come from Africa. The chain represents unity.
Randy?
And for a local number for the band Passion is 213-305-4250. We do all types of music: blues, funk, rock, Latin, hip hop, ska, reggae, whatever you want. If we don't know it, we'll learn it.
Okay. Thank you. I want to thank our guests, our in-studio guests, for tuning in to the Qumran Report. And I leave you with a clip.